We move to the sixth case, U.S. versus Scott. Christensen.
May it please the court, counsel. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Joanna Christensen, and I represent the appellant, Matthew Scott, in this matter. The 10-year sentence imposed onto Mr. Scott by the district court was unreasonable for four reasons. The court miscalculated the number of victims, relied on factually erroneous statements, failed to make adequate findings to justify the more than twice guideline sentence, and that sentence was, in fact, double the low end of the guideline range. First, focusing on the number of victims. As the court has seen in the appendix to our brief, it's obvious from the chart provided by the government on the day of sentencing that the victims have been, in some cases, double counted. In some cases, it's unclear how they count as victims at all. Some of the investments are unclear who they originated from, whether they originated from an individual or from a business. One individual stated in his victim statement that he invested his workers' compensation award, but his business was also counted as a victim, which would not be possible given the facts of this case. The government argues, of course, that we have waived this issue rather than forfeited, and while we admit we did not raise the issue specifically below, we assert that it has not been waived, rather it was forfeited. Significantly, there was no reason, strategic reason, not to raise this issue. The government hints that Mr. Scott might have lost acceptance of responsibility, but that wasn't a likely outcome in this case, given that he had cooperated with the government from the very beginning, in fact, pled to an information rather than an indictment, pled guilty, and assisted the government in calculating the restitution and loss amounts, as well as the number of victims, right up into the day of sentencing.
When we have the numbers that are thrown around in here, I read somewhere, what, 28 million?
The amount that was invested was close to 35 million.
Okay, when you say invested, the amount that Mr. Scott received from various people?
Right, but nearly 30 million of that was paid back out to investors.
Right, that's what you do in a pyramid scheme.
Right.
You take a lot and give some back as you go along. And I'm just wondering if those so-called victims, maybe some got all their money back.
Actually, some of the victims did get all their money back. Some of the victims got significant return on their investment.
Are they counted as victims?
Unfortunately, it's very unclear from the chart. What I took is everybody that had a number of loss by their name on the chart, because it's very unclear. And I did not count the people who had a gain, which is also listed on the government's restitution chart. We, of course, admit it could be more clear. It would be helpful to have just victims who had a loss listed rather than people who had a gain, but the chart includes both.
I didn't mean to interrupt you there, just to clarify here. Is there some attempt to recover from some of those who came out much better by getting in early than those that got in late?
Not that I'm aware of.
Is that sort of like the Madoff thing where they're...
on the same scale.
Well, it's pretty big, though.
But not that I'm aware of, and
certainly I assume some people lost a lot.
Yes.
Especially the ones that got in late.
Yes.
That's usually what happens. And so
we're certainly not contesting that there are some victims that lost everything they invested. On the flip side, there were some investors who got, you know,
sure,
they
got the late money.
Right. 30-40% gain on their investment. But that portion was not at least made part of the record. And, of course, I was not trial counsel, so I'm not aware if that was part
of the record. Mr. Scott's gain, I assume, was about whatever the restitution amount is, $4.5 million or something.
$4.5 million. There were a couple, 4.9 and 4.5 were thrown around.
All right, $5 million.
But approximately $5 million was what ended up being left. And I've taken out and put in my factual statement the people who were actually listed as victims who lost in a chart in my factual statement, lost money. And everybody that's listed is grouped by person or business name, and then there are several entries under each business name. So it's a little unclear if people who held a closely held business invested business money or personal money. And that's a problem with the number of victims. Because if you look at it and you cut it down, it's under 50 victims. Whereas the district court sentenced Mr. Scott as if he had defrauded 250 people with the upward variance that the district court imposed.
You see, just because he went above whatever 75
right.
would have been.
And he actually went above what it would have been if he had taken money from 250 people, which is five times the number that he actually took money from. And that's part of our reasonableness inquiry, is that the judge has essentially double counted these victims. One could say he's quintuple counted the victims when he goes up that high beyond what the guidelines have prescribed for this kind of loss and for this number of victims. The court also made several erroneous statements about the victims and how much they had lost. The most significant one was Mr. Calabria. The court said that Mr. Scott had taken $2.6 million from him and found this particularly persuasive in sentencing him. That would have been half of the amount of loss that Mr. Scott was held accountable for, but in fact, Mr. Calabria lost 10% of that. Still a significant loss, is about $260,000, but not the impact that the district court thought and relied on that loss having on Mr. Calabria. There were also errors in the amount for Mr. Pillay and Mr. Slavik that the district court relied on and, again, felt very swayed by those.
Is that basically what they, quote, invested versus what they actually lost? Is that the distinction you're making?
They said that they lost. Many of them said that they had invested this much with Mr. Scott. And those numbers were close, but not accurate either, according to the government's loss chart. There was a significant shift between what victims said they lost and what victims actually lost. And I certainly understand when a victim is talking about being victimized and the feeling of being victimized much higher than you actually were. Unfortunately,
let me ask you about the Slavik. I mean, that's the chart in your brief shows that he invested or paid $1,085,000 mm-hmm. and got back $1,035,000.
Yeah.
Loss of $49,000.
Right. So we're certain they had loss, just not at the level that the district court is thinking in this case. And in this case, with the significant thought that the district court put on the victims in sentencing a double of low guideline sentence, it's just not meted out by the record in this case. I see I'm in my rebuttal time, and I'll save the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court, counsel. My name is Philip Floor, and I represent the United States in this matter. The defendant entered into a written plea agreement in December of 2009 in which he agreed that there were 50 victims in this case that sustained an actual loss. Your Honors, that is waiver. Several months after that plea agreement was entered into at the sentencing hearing, the defendant, through his counsel, agreed that the sentencing guideline computation of 26 appropriately considered the number of people that were victimized by the defendant. Now, the defendant now on appeal is stating that there was no strategic reason for the defendant to have waived his challenge to the number of victims. What the defendant was doing at the sentencing hearing and throughout his cooperation was to present himself in the most remorseful and cooperative light as he could. Not only would this help him preserve the three-point credit for acceptance of responsibility, but it would signify to the sentencing court that he was completely surrendering and throwing himself on the mercy of the court. Throughout the sentencing hearing, the defendant and his counsel made numerous references to his cooperation. They cited his spending countless hours with agents of the government to help calculate the loss and compute the restitution amount. He stated that he was contrite. He stated that they underwent numerous hours of debriefing. They had conference calls with the government. So this essentially was the only tact he had at sentencing, was to demonstrate that he cooperated, because there was no co-conspirator to testify against or roll on. And there was no restitution made. There was no restitution that he could point to, despite the passage of numerous months between the investigation coming to light and his fraud being revealed and sentencing. He didn't pay so much as a penny to any of the victims.
I assume the count included some of the victims that may have gotten their money back.
Your Honor, the count of 73, which is what defendant acknowledges in their brief and is from a plain reading of the lost restitution summary entered at sentencing, that only accounts for those individuals who sustain a positive loss amount. There were 84 individuals and entities reflected on that chart, but the 73 only accounts for those that actually had a positive loss.
You say a positive loss, did you say?
Your Honor, a figure of greater than $1.
I just want to make sure it's not an oxymoron there. There's nothing positive about a loss. Okay.
Absolutely, Your Honor. But in this context, we're talking about actual loss. We're talking about actual loss as it's defined in the sentencing guidelines, an actual pecuniary loss. What some of the victims felt, and this gets into the victim impact, they were also concerned with what their expectation was and what their perception of their loss was. So I think there's a distinction to be drawn between actual loss as it's defined in the sentencing guidelines and victim impact, because a number of the victims experienced personally much greater loss because they were told lies on numerous occasions by the defendant, which led them to believe that the amount that their investment had grown substantially. So for the sake of argument, if they had invested $100,000 with him, they might have expected over the course of time, because he was telling them about this high rate of return, 10 to 12% in a short period of time, that they might have $200,000 or $250,000. Now, when the actual exercise of meeting with the government and going through the bank records was undertaken, the actual loss, as reflected ultimately in the loss restitution summary, might have been, in fact, just $100,000. So there is certainly a distinction to be drawn between loss and victim impact. But, Your Honors, even if the defendant did not waive the argument as to the number of victims, and it's merely deemed to have been forfeited, the district court did not plainly err in calculating the number of victims. There were several instances on the record when the number of victims was addressed. Again, there was a plea agreement that specified greater than 50 victims. That was entered into in December of 2009, and the judge below accepted that at a change of plea hearing in January of 2010. After that was received, the government submitted to the probation office its version of the offense. That document specified greater than 60 victims. The defendant never opposed that government version. Several months after that was received, the probation office produced its pre-sentence investigation report. That document also specified greater than 50 victims and specified that the four-point enhancement under U.S. Sentencing Guideline 2B1.1 should apply. And then finally, as I noted earlier, the defense counsel's own statements at sentencing, after months of meeting with the government, considering the bank records that were available from the victims, after victim interviews were undertaken, and all those meetings, the defense stated at sentencing that the guideline calculation figure of 26 appropriately accounted for the number of people that were victimized. Now, the basis for the defendant's challenge here is that the loss restitution summary is somehow flawed. I would point out a couple things factually about that document. First of all, it was intended to guide the restitution amount. It was not intended to provide a definitive number for the number of victims involved in the case, although it can be used for that purpose on plain error review. As its title suggests, the document was intended to provide a definitive accounting of the loss amount and the restitution to be paid by the defendant. And I would note that that process resulted in a credit to the defendant, as reflected on the last page of the document, which is page 11 of record item 20. There is $721,000 were credited back to the defendant and diminished the loss amount, diminished the restitution amount through that process. So, and it's also significant to note that this document was created on the basis of bank records. Now, those bank records, unfortunately, were not made part of the record, but the bank records were received from a number of victims, and it's those documents that formed the basis of the loss restitution summary. So I think we can safely infer that if an individual was listed alone, not with a spouse, not with a business entity, that that's what the bank record supported. On the other hand, if an individual was listed with his or her spouse, that there was a demonstration in the underlying bank records to support both of those individuals being, for example, listed as joint account holders, such that they would both be entitled to be considered victims in the matter. With respect to the reasonableness of the sentence, the district court did not rely solely on the number of victims. In fact, there were a number of other things that the district court deemed to be significant in such a way that the sentence was adequately explained and creates a meaningful record to allow for meaningful appellate review. There were three factors that were particularly significant in the district court's view. Before I discuss them, I'll note a couple of the points on the record. The district court described the defendant's conduct as despicable, outrageous, and tragic. He pointed to a combination of factors, essentially concluding that the defendant was of a depraved character. He noted that he abused essentially his personal relationships. These weren't arm's-length transactions. The defendant did not send out a prospectus to potential investors. These were friends. These were neighbors that he preyed upon. He exploited those close relationships to advance his fraud, and the district court felt that he was somebody that would do anything and say anything to advance his own ends. And the district court was also compelled by the impact on the victims. Now, this is not a situation where we had a full-blown trial where there's a lot of testimony, but it is significant that there were three individuals who stood up at sentencing and addressed the court, and there were a number of other victims who were there that were also present. So I think it's appropriate to accord the district court's view in that sense with some deference. Finally, the district court was persuaded by the length of the fraud, which is not accounted for in the sentencing guidelines. This was a fraud that occurred over a period of 9 years. The defendant had to meet with his victims on numerous occasions to engender their trust and assure them that their funds were safe. Under these circumstances, an above-guideline sentence was not unreasonable. And if there are no other questions, I'll ask that you affirm the sentence that was imposed on the defendant.
Thank you, counsel. How much time? You have 2 minutes, Ms. Christensen.
Briefly, Your Honors. I'll talk first about the waiver. The plea agreement did contain an admission to over 50 victims. It also contained a portion that stated that they agreed that the guidelines were preliminary in nature and could change if the government received more information. And that's exactly what happened between change of plea of sentencing. Mr. Scott talked to the government. They worked through this amount of loss restitution summary up until the day of sentencing. And some inference from my part is that defense counsel simply neglected to recount the victims after all that negotiation. That's a forfeiture rather than a waiver. Forgetting to recount victims is unfortunate, but in the case where it's so glaringly obviously from the record that there are people counted who should not be counted, this court should remand for resentencing. About the reasonableness, all of the factors that the district court commented on in Mr. Scott's case are significant factors for sentencing. Unfortunately, they are also all factors that are in every white-collar fraud case. I do a lot of these cases. This court sees a lot of these cases. They're often based on close personal relationships. They're often long-term with multiple acts of fraud.
If you can't cheat your friends, who can you cheat?
Exactly, Your Honor.
It's almost a civil rights violation.
And those are items that occur in every white-collar case. In nearly every white-collar case. It's very rare that you see people that don't know their victims in some way. And the guidelines take account of those characteristics of the offense and recommend a guideline range that is half what the district court imposed in this case. So with all respect, Mr. Scott asks that you reverse and remand this matter for resentencing. Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.